where is the one place in the public sphere where we see people of different backgrounds, different racial and religious perspectives and identities, different socioeconomic statuses, different geographic perspectives, different political beliefs, all working together for a common goal? The one place we see that is on our professional sports teams. We don't see that in other spaces anymore in the way that we used to. All working together in a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition over a shared goal in a way that is inspiring, that we need.
So this is How Do You Like It So Far, a podcast about popular culture in our changing world. And I'm Henry Jenkins.
And I'm Colin McClay. And today we are thrilled to have our friend and colleague Varun Soni, who's the USC Dean of Religious and Spiritual Life, among many other important and interesting roles he plays on campus and off.
So we wanted to start by talking a little bit about that on-campus role before we broaden out to talk about some of your interests in sports and music and other things. So you recently published an essay about how universities might meet the needs of students during the pandemic. And you ask, how do students stay spiritually connected while they're physically isolated? How do they practice social distancing without emotional distancing? If anything, those issues have intensified as we've started back in the fall. So how are you thinking today about those questions? What are universities doing right, and what are they failing to do that might address those questions for their students?
Thank you. Thank you for having me today. It's really a great joy to be with you and to participate in this wonderful podcast and to talk about things that really matter. So thank you for that. I think all universities are struggling with similar issues. First and foremost, the universities have thought about how do we move teaching and research online. Research is not something you can really do online. So even though universities are closed, many of them are closed, there's still some research activities going on. The teaching is a difficult thing to move online, but I think professors are navigating it. You know, they've been teaching their whole careers, and now they're teaching in a different format, but they're still teaching. For me, the big challenge is all the other stuff that happens on a college campus, especially for undergraduate students. Because as you know, one of the joys of being on a residential campus like USC is getting to know people, is getting to grow alongside people. This is the one time students can be with others who are their age from 120 different countries, all 50 states, who have a diversity of identities, perspectives, worldviews, and experiences. And we know that learning about other people is a good way to learn about the world, but knowing other people is really what transforms students. It transforms hearts and minds. I can teach about Islam in a class, but knowing a Muslim student is what's going to change the way students think about Islam, not just what they're learning in the class. There's no easy way to replicate that online, the kind of empathy and trust that comes out of interpersonal human relationships is limited online. I don't have any doubt that we're going to be able to continue to teach online. And I don't have any doubt that post-pandemic, universities will continue to offer hybrid opportunities. I don't think we'll ever go back to fully in-person at the undergraduate level because the disruption has forced the technology and the pedagogy to move forward. But I do think after this, we're going to re-embrace what it means to be together. We're not wired to be apart. This is not part of our DNA. This is hard because it's not natural. As human beings, we are tribal people. We are social creatures. We need clan. We need community. We need tribe. Our students were already really lonely before the pandemic. This is the loneliest generation that we've seen probably in American history. A new study showed that 18 to 22-year-olds are the loneliest people in America. Those are college students. And so this pandemic has only made it worse. 80% of our students say that the pandemic has negatively impacted their mental, emotional, and spiritual health and their career aspirations, which is also causing them existential angst. So what can we do? The reality is all we can do is be online. And so we're doing things at USC and around the country. For example, we're offering mindfulness classes. We used to have 300 people sign up every session for mindfulness classes. This year, we had 1,200 people sign up for our first session, including 500 on the waiting list. So, you know, that sort of demand for those kinds of activities has exploded. We're getting more people into worship services, into Bible study classes, into sort of just hangout groups than we've ever had before. And we're having all these conversations on well-being and thriving and flourishing during the pandemic that are really well attended. But it's still a limited way to engage. You know, I'm doing all these events on burnout and I'm talking about Zoom burnout and I'm doing them on Zoom, you know? And so like I'm on Zoom talking about what the problem is with Zoom. It's like, why it would have been better if we just didn't do a webinar and people turned off their computers, right? So even the solutions to get around the online sort of angst and the limited ability of Zoom to connect us as humans are happening online and in Zoom. And so we are limited. And, you know, the reality is that at some point we will be past the pandemic and past the physical harm that that could cause students. But we're not going to be past the emotional, mental, and spiritual health crisis that will only be exacerbated by that. That's going to endure beyond the pandemic. And that's really what universities need to also be thinking about, that that we'll get past the pandemic. The universities are spending $70 billion this year across the country to keep kids physically safe from COVID. But what are we going to spend in next year and the year after to keep kids spiritually, emotionally, and mentally uplifted, engaged, and resilient?
I mean, I feel like we're, as the natural state of things, unfortunately, that we were reactive to the crisis that we're in, and we respond to the pressures that we're experiencing now. But exactly as you're saying, what we really need to be doing is anticipating what's going to happen next, because those pressures are just magnified in the current moment, but they're not going to be going away, right? We need to chip away at that loneliness that predated the COVID, the current crisis, and recognize that, you know, things weren't working that well beforehand. So let's not go back to where we were. It's envision a new future and think about how we get to that more sustainable, more real future. So we, you know, can really realize the promise of university, of communities, of our societies. And with the current, you know, crises, all that, you know, we were talking about all the different elements of the apocalypse, which seem to be upon us. It just seems really hard to get to where we really need to go, which is that more visionary future.
You know, as human beings, we need forward orientation. We need something to look forward to. That's a protective factor for us. But we don't have that much really that collectively that we're thinking about in terms of looking forward. And we haven't even really reflected on what's happening. Yesterday was a tragic day. We had passed the 200,000 death, American death mark for COVID. We haven't had a single moment of national reflection or mourning or ritual to even think or process what we've been through. This is the third largest number of casualties in American history after the Civil War and the 1918 pandemic.
Varun corrected himself later, noting that COVID is actually the fourth most deaths in history with the addition of World War II.
And yet there's been no moment of reflection. And so we haven't reflected on what's happening, and we're not really sure where we're going in the future. And I think that has caused a lot of uneasiness, really, across the country and across our campus. And so that's the big challenge. You know, how do we think about what the world will look like in the future when we haven't really processed what the world looks like now? I think you're right that there's no going back to a pre-pandemic world, and we shouldn't want to go back to a pre-pandemic world. Over the last 6 months, we have seen issues of policing and inequality with healthcare and employment discrimination and environmental degradation and how we treat animals that have really been put into the spotlight. We shouldn't ever go back to the way things were. And so the question is, how do we tell a new story about the future? How do we reimagine the world anew? In Hindu theology, there's a really important deity, Shiva. He's often considered Shiva Nataraj. He's thought of as the Lord of Destruction. He dances the cosmic dance that keeps the universe going. And when he stops dancing, the universe ends. But what Shiva really represents is creation that can only come out of destruction. The new can only come out of the death of the old. So that's the kind of moment I think we're in right now, this really difficult, transformative moment of change where we're witnessing the death of an old consciousness and way of being, hopefully giving birth to a new consciousness and a way of being that our students feel empowered to be a part of. And how we move forward, I think, is by telling individual and collective stories about what it means to be human and what our values are. And that's where I hope our students find some kind of empowerment in telling those stories, in charting that new future, and in entering a new world where in many ways there will be a level playing field for students who are thinking about what will the world look like in 5 years.
Well, I think one of the things the three of us have in common is that we see pop culture as one of the venues where telling new stories of racing values take place. So what role do you think pop culture can or should play in responding to the situation you've been describing here?
Yeah, I mean, it's been critical during COVID. All of us, you know, popular culture, however you define it, film, fashion, music, art, poetry, sports, they offer us a new language that is a global language to connect across our traditional divides at a time when we don't have global languages that cut across traditional divides. In every other sphere, you know, religion is polarized, politics are polarized, class is polarized. You know, going into the most contentious election of our lifetime, it's only going to get worse. But we can still talk about sports and film and music in a way that connects people across disparate identities. And so in many ways, it is, you know, I think popular culture doesn't get enough credit for being a avenue of reconciliation and understanding and engagement. I view popular culture in the same way that I view the aspirations of religion, to connect us fundamentally with what it means to be human. So I put popular culture sort of at the highest level in terms of our salvation. We can only tell new stories through these new mediums and technologies and platforms. There's never been a better time to tell a new story, and there's never been more platforms to tell those stories. So, you know, with the Emmys, there was this comment made that, you know, television has never been more important because all of us are watching a lot of content in a way that connects us and that we're sharing that content with each other. And a lot of that content that we're consuming are about issues of the day. You know, they're about black and brown stories. They're about racial justice. They're about the impact of social media. They're about how we treat animals. They're about climate change, right? They're about the political season upon us. And so popular culture gives us a framework to talk about these issues in a way that becomes very difficult in other public sphere spaces, especially because we're not together. This is a way for us to feel like we're together. And I don't think there's any more important example than the NBA. You know, the pandemic felt very real for people when the NBA stopped playing. The NBA stopped, and that was like the sign that, oh, we're in some different space now. And when the NBA started up again, in some ways, it gave people a glimpse of a future where they could return back to the activities they love. And so in many ways, the start and sort of resumption of the NBA season is a barometer for a lot of people in terms of the reality of what we're living in. Two things happened at the same time. Sports stopped and worship services stopped. And that made it really, that made it very real for people, because sports and worship services were sanctuaries for people during times of turmoil. And when they stopped, there wasn't even that sanctuary for people to sort of to enter into.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the connection between those two things. So you're a part of this Religion of Sports project, and on its webpage, I see the statement, sports aren't like religion, sports are religion. So what does that project posit as the connection between those two things? And how are we defining religion to bring those worlds together?
Yeah, so, you know, religion is a unique thing. There are not a lot of fields where scholars disagree on how to define the field itself. But religion is one of those things where if you ask religion scholars or religious studies scholars, what is religion, you'll get, you know, 20 different answers from 20 different people. So there's not even a consensus on how to define religion from the point of view of scholars themselves. I was taught by Kathy Albanese, a great scholar of American religion, and her definition is the one that I teach my students, the four C's of religion. How do we define religion? Well, there's a code that you live by, like the rules of the game, the ethical framework, the Ten Commandments, et cetera. There's the creed. That's the worldview. What's our place in the world? You know, how do we make sense of the world? What do we believe? There's cultists, which are the rituals, the pilgrimages, sacraments, the songs. And then there's community, which is the most important thing. How do we come together? God is not part of that definition. You know, you don't need to be theistic to be religious. Just ask 650 million Buddhists who are not theistic but are religious. And so that if we define religion through those four C's, then sports checks all those boxes. For us in Religion of Sports, we see sports as a new organized religion at a time when religion is not prevalent in the lives of young people. In 1950, 2% of Americans were not affiliated with religion. 2%. This year, coming into USC, 45% of our first-year students are not affiliated with religion. That is a dramatic change that will never go back to a predominantly religious society after as we go through the Gen X experience, or sorry, Gen Z experience. It'll never go back that way. This is the most important story in religion right now, the massive disaffiliation. But when students walk away from religion, they don't walk away from meaning or purpose or significance or identity or community or authenticity or joy or gratitude or any of the other things that religion aspires to create in the world. They're just walking away from the formal affiliation with institutions that they feel have betrayed those values in the way they've acted and moved. And so sports has become that place. When I became the Dean of Religious Life at USC, people are like, oh, you're the Dean of Religious Life. You should know that the real religion here is football. And I'm like, ha ha, that's cute. Until I went to a football game and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. That's where I saw pilgrimage. That's where I saw intergenerational transmission of wisdom. That's where I saw mythology, agony, ecstasy. That's where I saw, you know, the rituals of the day. That's where I saw Trojan religion. And that's the way we think about the religion of sports. Religion does provide for its practitioners and followers the things that religion has historically provided: meaning, purpose, ritual, community, transcendence, awe, agony, ecstasy, intergenerational community, all the things that we need to be human. Religion tells us what it means to be human, not what it means to be God. This is an expression of what it means to be human in the same way that sports are. And what we need right now in our life is a reconnection to what it means to be human. I think sports provides that, especially for young people, in a way that religion is not providing that for many young people right now.
Oof, that's intense and super compelling. And also there's some kind of odd juxtaposition with that sort of stirring set of statements and then all the, you know, the kind of business aspects of sports, right? Whether it's the, you know, it's what, you know, as you described, the NBA bubble, which is, you know, maybe what our future is, but it cost them whatever, $150 million to create the NBA bubble, or the risks that it, that we may be placing college athletes at if they resume their seasons. So there's this sort of, you know, funny juxtaposition of something that is a form of a religion in ways that we, as we've been saying, absolutely need and are craving, especially right now, and that the normalcy and sanctuary and community and the way that it interacts with big business. And then what it, you know, it feels to me that one of the interesting things is you're going back to the NBA season that is so remarkable is the kind of explicit incorporation, intentional incorporation of social activism and social justice, and especially around Black Lives Matter and, you know, current movements against systemic racism, to see that sort of shift in the business that incorporates it, not just giving athletes voice because they're visible and there's we care about them, but also like this acknowledgement that there's either a responsibility or an opportunity or they need to do it.
Yeah, I think that point is astute, that there is this big business component to sports, but there's also a big business or commerce or money component to religion, right? And so in some ways that makes it more like religion. It's not just religion in its light, it's also religion in its shadow, you know? What we see in religion, we also see in sports, from, you know, assault to abuse to, you know, marginalization to sexism to what have you, exploitation. So it's not to say that either sports or religion are these lights on the hill. They are messy in the way that humans are messy, but they are expressions of that messiness because they are expressions of what it means to be human. But I think what you're saying is also true with the what we're seeing, especially with the NBA, that once there are financial interests at stake, once there's Derek Bell called interest convergence, like a bunch of different things coming together, then you can actually get real social change, you know? The NBA players who participated in the strike and who in some ways threatened to continue that strike put real money at risk for the NBA in a way that caused them to move on other issues, including issues of policing and police reform, in ways that we've never really seen athletes be able to move policy. Like, athletes have always been on the front lines of social justice. Our greatest athletes, I think, are great because of that. People like Bill Russell and Muhammad Ali and others. But now they're actually shaping policy. It's the basketball players who are on the phone with the governors and on the phone with the police commissioners. I think LeBron James is the most powerful athlete who's ever lived in American history. The owners are asking LeBron, are we going to play or not going to play? The owners are asking LeBron, what are we going to do? LeBron is the one who's organizing the voting drives that have turned NBA arenas into voting centers. If you think about the fact that the last election was swayed by 70,000 votes in five different counties, you know, that's like, you know, one, the Staples Center could potentially register and support 70,000 votes in and of itself. So these things could actually have dramatic changes. And I think the NBA is the league that does that more than the other leagues, because the NBA right now is a player-driven league and not an owner-driven league in the way that the NFL is. So the players can get past some of the challenges and can sort of put some of that money at risk and hold the owners accountable to align their rhetoric with their values and their actions in a way that I think the NFL is still, a lot of the rhetoric is still coming from the owners as opposed to the players.
Yeah. And it's weird to say that the players are more like us as other, you know, residents of the United States than the owners are, right? Who are, you know, billionaires or whatever, but they have a closer view. They have experienced racial profiling or police brutality or poverty. It's also, to me at least, really interesting. I mean, this again, this buoys my enthusiasm for NBA because it is player driven in that way and engaging. But really, this builds on a good 4 years of activism in the WNBA. So again, women have led the way, right, with their sustained activism, not as much attention because the WNBA just isn't as visible as the NBA, but they have absolutely been out there, including in political fights with the owner of the Atlanta Dream, right, like who has come out against Black Lives Matter and fighting back against her, or working with Planned Parenthood in the past. So remarkably active as a league for four or so years, right? Or maybe longer.
Yeah, I wish the WNBA also got the profile that the NBA got. To me, the WNBA is actually the really inspiring story in sports too. And it also shows still biases in how we report these kinds of stories, right? That the WNBA hasn't gotten the same kind of profile. There are sort of one-off stories about individual NBA players, but I haven't seen the big stories about the league as a whole. I think we saw some of this with the women's national soccer team, especially with Megan Rapinoe. Like we saw how when the spotlight is on these teams are using the spotlight to focus on societal issues. Normally, when the spotlight is on celebrity, that spotlight is used to further celebrity's own social or cultural capital. Now the spotlight is being used to highlight issues that aren't self-promoting, but that go to what justice looks like in America right now. And so I do think that when we talk about these great historic sports figures who are on the front lines of social justice, we often talk about men like Muhammad Ali, like, you know, Bill Russell, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, et cetera. I think now we're going to hopefully have a new landscape where we talk about women who are also on the front lines. They have historically been, but they just haven't gotten the attention.
And so do you think that, I mean, so just thinking about the implications of this kind of sports activism, right? So you talked about how it could change, sway voting, of course, a huge deal in this particular moment. But thinking about that example, does that change, you know, my daughter, who's a huge Megan Rapinoe fan, is that going to change the next generation in terms of what they expect from athletes, but also those who become professional athletes and the way that they engage with the world? Because I think for a long time, there's been a reticence, as you said, among famous folk to engage, and most of them to engage in social issues for fear of alienating their audience or their fans. And now it feels like either they're realizing that the world is on fire and they need to help, or they're realizing that expectations across social settings and sectors are that leaders actually lead, whether they're business leaders or athletes or others, that they take a stand on the things that matter most.
I hope, you know, here's the challenge. It's not up to athletes to solve the problems of the world. And it's certainly not up to Black athletes who have been the victim of systemic racism to then be the remedy for systemic racism, right? At the same time, it's undeniable what kind of power athletes have in our society to move the conversation. I mean, just look at what Kaepernick has done and how much that conversation has moved in the last 4 years. And it's hard to imagine anyone else in that kind of role, especially a politician who is within the system. The thing about an athlete or an artist or a poet or an actor is that they're outside the system, right? They can offer a critique of the system and have that sort of perspective They're not within it in and of itself in the way politicians are. And so my hope is that your daughter, my daughter, do expect athletes to be authentic in their values. That might look different for different athletes. It doesn't mean that every athlete has to be on the front lines of every social justice movement, but that athletes are authentic in the issues that mean a lot to them, whatever those issues are, and that they care, and that it's not just about them, that they use their spotlight to lift everyone up. Maybe that's unfair for athletes, but that's a beautiful expectation for young children to expect from people who they see as leaders.
I could hear how, sorry, I like that, all that a lot. That's super helpful. But I'm also just thinking about the teams that you play on as a young person, right? And I would argue that, like, in this period for many of us of remote learning, air quotes around the learning part, is that one of the biggest losses is around physical fitness and team sports, right? We can no longer play those things. And I think so much powerful social emotional connection and learning about leadership and what happens with your teammate, you know, when you, whether it's pat them on the back or kick them on the behind, is that we work together. And so you want to see that same sort of, you know, not the, you know, kind of national scale political leadership, but the local way in which everyone on a team is part leader and part follower, in which we work together. So I could also imagine what that looks like to take a stand on what's right just in our own communities.
Protecting, I think that's others, right. Where is the one place in the public sphere where we see people of different backgrounds, different sort of racial and religious perspectives and identities, different socioeconomic statuses, different geographic perspectives, different political beliefs, all working together for a common goal? The one place we see that is on our professional sports teams. We don't see that in other spaces anymore in the way that we used to. All working together in a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition over a shared goal in a way that is inspiring, that we need. So I think we lose that symbolic perspective of how we work together when we don't see sports teams or when we don't play on sports teams, because that's an experience of connecting across difference. But the other part of this is the spiritual or emotional lessons of sports that could also be lost. One of the things that drove us with religion of sports is when we learned that church was rescheduling Sunday services around AYSO soccer because parents were taking their kids to soccer to learn the lessons that they used to take their kids to church to learn. Parents were like, we want to take our kids to soccer because that's where they learn it's not about winning or losing, but how you play. That's where they learn how to get along with each other. That's how they learn how to be competitive but collaborative. That's how they learn how to work together as a team. Those are the ethics that we go to church for, but we're getting them on the soccer field plus physical fitness. And so it used to be that AYSO soccer would organize around worship services, and now worship services are organizing around soccer, right? And so you can see that for our children, these are spiritual, emotional, ethical lessons that are now coming through sports that used to come through religion.
Going back to your definition of religion, you've talked a bit about creed and belief structure and community, but the cult part I wanted to pull out a little more. And I'm thinking about this gesture of taking the knee, which has proven to be so divisive in recent years and has yet been symbolic of the political voice you've been talking about. And when I first encountered Trump's attack on taking the knee, it was in the middle of watching Game of Thrones, where taking the knee is seen as a gesture of respect to a liege, right? That it's a ritual of, you know, a deeply respectful ritual. And it would be if I kneeled in front of a church. So I'm wondering in what way taking the knee became divisive and read as an act of disrespect for the nation as opposed to a call to the nation's highest value.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think historically taking a knee has been a sign of respect or deference. There's a beautiful image of Martin Luther King Jr. taking a knee as he prays. And let's not forget that it was Colin Kaepernick who popularized this as an act of protest. And Colin Kaepernick is a quarterback, and quarterbacks do take a knee in the course of a game. That's what quarterbacks do, right? And so it was very organic in terms of his own role of, all right, we're going to stop the play and sort of take the time out, you know? And that's what he was saying when he was taking a knee. Let's just take a moment and reflect upon what, you know, he wanted to bring to light, which was police brutality. And so the way Kaepernick saw his protest was that it wasn't anything about the anthem. It was about protesting police brutality. But because it it happened within the context of the anthem. I think other people, and this was part of the culture wars, conflated it with disrespect to the flag. And that was never his intention. And he said that over and over again. And so I think that this just became politicized in a way that things are in our society, especially as we were going into an election season, and now we're going into another election season. And there are election issues that pop up in the election year and then go away and then pop up again because they're part of the culture wars that are driving people to the polls. What I think is remarkable about this, though, is that if you took a knee, you know, a few years ago, you were essentially blacklisted. And we know that Colin was. I mean, there was a lawsuit that shows that. But now if you don't take a knee, you're kind of called out, right? The discourse has changed so much in just 4 years. I think that's the really remarkable thing, how something that was thought of as controversial so long ago, now if you don't do it, that's actually it used to be that the athletes who were taking a knee were being called out, and now the athletes who are not taking a knee are kind of being called out. And so it shows us how quickly things can change. It also shows us how prescient Colin was, like in terms of what he was doing and the way he was doing it. And so I think it's the politics of it. It's not the intention. There was never an intention to disrespect, you know, even players who have police officers in their family or are part of veteran families, or coaches who, have family members in law enforcement are taking knees, not because they're disrespecting their family members or their sacrifices, but because they're protesting what are obvious ongoing, enduring, systemic injustices around policing and criminal justice.
Well, to pull the ritual in a different direction, I'm interested in the tomahawk chop and similar gestures, right? We've seen teams, after decades of dispute about team mascots, moving to change their names. But as we begin to bring fans back into the stadium, will these rituals, which have been dispersed, starting out top-down maybe, but are now dispersed across the population, are we likely to see struggles over rituals? Even thinking them as rituals implies something that's deeply embedded, that's socially and culturally significant, that's something people do over and over as an expression of their community and belief. Does this thinking of this as a religious space shed any light on the struggles we're going to be having over those gestures before much longer?
I think they do. I think that's really astute. I think that rituals are important because they make sense of the world. They give us a way to order what seems like disorder or chaos. They give us a way to ground ourselves amidst the fact that we are part of this larger universe, which is hard to comprehend. And so we all have rituals, whether we think of them as rituals or not. We all have things that we do daily in some ways that give us a sense of order in our life or ground us in a particular moment. And so that is very much, you know, a part of being human, a very much part of being religious, et cetera. I think the challenge here is that we think of ritual as a connection to the past. And if we aren't doing these rituals, then we're dishonoring the past. I think what religion and sports have to do is to reimagine rituals for the future. It's not the case that you can't reimagine a ritual. A ritual is important, but rituals were once new and now they're old. They can be new again. And I think that's the thing that religion has struggled with, is to come to the contemporary moment. So much of what young people think about religion is about the past. So much of what young people think about religion is what happened 2,000 years ago in a place they'll never visit. So much of what young people think about religion is that transcendence, beauty, awe, revelation happened in the past. It's not, there has to be a greater emphasis on actually religion is telling us about what's happening in the moment. You have blessing and awe and transcendence in your life right now, and you can reinterpret religious texts in a way that makes sense for you. In fact, every act of reading every text is an act of interpretation. There's no way to literally interpret any religious texts because religious texts are antithetical in and of themselves. You know, what is the Bible? Is it an eye for an eye or is it turn the other cheek? Well, it's both. And the reason why it's endured is because it's malleable, because it's open to interpretation. And the way the U.S. Constitution has endured because it's open to interpretation, we have to think of rituals in the same way, that the way we interpret our religious texts tell us more about ourselves in some ways than they tell us about the text. If we interpret a text as a peaceful text, we're probably peaceful people. If we interpret the text as a violent text, we're probably violent people. The text is a mirror for who we are. We read ourselves into the text. We should see the same thing in ritual. We could redefine rituals as a mirror for who we are. If these rituals, which exploit indigenous traditions in a way that's very demeaning and harmful to those to those cultures and people don't resonate with us, then we should be able to reinterpret those rituals. We can take the spirit of what it means to have a ritual to bring us together with community, to put us in a chain of generations, to make order of the disorder, to be inspiring in moments of defeat. Fine, the spirit of the ritual can endure, but the rituals themselves can be reinterpreted as a mirror for who we are now. And quite frankly, who we are now is very different than who we were just 1 year ago. I've never seen consciousness change so quickly across the world in our lifetime. We've never had a shared moment of suffering in the way we're having now in our lifetimes. Even the other moments of suffering, war, 9/11, economic collapse, affected different people in different regions differently. But this is a shared global sense of suffering that should empower us to reinterpret our rituals, our texts in a way that align with who we are now, the new people that we are now, the new consciousness that we have now.
So that feels promising, like the opportunity for these teams and communities is to, again, to think ahead of less of who we have been and more who we want to be. I'm always surprised, though, at how much, I mean, I shouldn't be surprised, at how much resistance there is to change and how much locking into the past, into our history there is. And that does to me feel, I often will describe it as religious in nature, right? Like, we didn't reach these conclusions to be a fan of this or a member of that party because of, logical sort of deliberations. It's because our parent or our whatever, or we grew up this way. And then we kind of hold on to that. So it feels like what we need are both athletes and other kind of leaders within these, sports communities to be out there kind of pushing. Let's think about a more empowering vision, more empowering rituals, ways that we lay out the leadership that we're expressing on social media as like, here's the vision of where we're going as a society.
And I think young people have a particularly important role in this, because all change, significant change, happens, across generations. Change is slow. It's hard. Of course, Martin Luther King popularized the phrase, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. It doesn't turn immediately towards justice. There's a multi-generational approach towards justice that might have been accelerated, but young people have traditionally been at the forefront of this kind of change. And so my hope is that young people who have changed the world dramatically just in their summer of protests, I've never seen police reform or policing sort of questions being asked over 20 years in the way I saw them being asked over 20 days this summer. That's because young people were out there and their actions have resulted in real change. My hope is that they take hope from and inspiration from that summer to realize that they can make change in all sorts of spheres, and the time is now. And that might be older people might resist that, but change happens across generations. And so that's why it's so wonderful to work in a college. That's why I think we all do it, because we want to be part of that change, and we are part of that change through our work with students.
I mean, absolutely. Gen Z, as we like to say, is the most diverse generation, the most connected generation, the largest generation, right? It is teed up in so many ways and has already been, even pre-pandemic, was leading both in the ballot box and in the streets for, and this is, I know, what has driven and inspired so much of Henry's work and my own. So I definitely, not to again make them responsible for all the problems that we have created and or not solved, but they do give me tremendous hope.
That's right.
Well, I suspect I'm not alone in the audience, that I've struggled the last few years with this question of the connection of popular culture and religion. And you and Diane Winston and others here at USC have broadened my perspective about in what way we can think of popular culture as religion. But as someone from fandom studies, I still struggle with the fact that fandom, whether we're talking sports fandom or science fiction fandom, the root word for that was grounded in claims about false worship or false belief. And that has been a stigma that's attached to the category of fan over an extended period of time. So if we are going to blur that boundary, which you're doing a very convincing job of showing us why we should, and I'm mostly won over on this, but the question, if we blur that boundary, how do we deal with that historic stigma? And we can go back to sports fans. That category emerged in sports because these were people who were watching sports and not playing it, and that was seen as the wrong way to do sports. in the late 19th, early 20th century. So the false belief still surrounds fandom. How do we make it a valid belief? Is it about just pointing toward the future, as you've suggested, or is there something else that we should be doing or thinking about if we're going to move in that direction?
Yeah, that's good. You know, I think there's probably, you know, some sense of that now in terms of at least sports fandom, right? That I'm a Clippers fan, and so all my Lakers fans tell me that I have false belief, right? Or that I'm misguided, or I'm a heretic, or, you know, heterodox, or what have you. Similar categories or accusations against religious people where, you know, there is this idea that you're either on the right side or the wrong side, especially when you have these exclusionary truth claims that some traditions have, where it's like either it's my way or the highway. And so if you're not real, then you're fake. But I think that the idea of moving to real belief, or of honoring the fact that fans of any popular culture phenomenon find real meaning, purpose, and significance in their fandom in the way that devotees of any religious tradition find meaning, purpose, and significance in their devotion, is a story that will be told by fans themselves. That's what we're trying to do with religion of sports. Oftentimes these categories are categories that are put upon us, but what are the categories that that emerge from their self-generated? How do we identify? What's our story? How do we tell our narrative? And so my hope is that if we're going to get to a point where fandom is seen in the way that religious devotion or affiliation is seen, and that we can honor the spiritual significance of fandom as a protective factor for us as humans, then we do so by letting fans tell their stories. And with the explosion of blogs, sports blogs, with all these new platforms, even with these new fantasy leagues, I think people are invested in sports in a way that they weren't even 15 or 20 years ago. They're invested in sports communities in a way that they weren't. And they're telling stories about sports that they have not told before. And if you look at all these popular sports shows, from what we're doing at Religion of Sports to 30 for 30 to especially Real Sports on HBO, they're really stories about more about what it means to be human than they are about sports. Sports is the lens, but these are stories about redemption. These are stories about triumph. These are stories about reconciliation. These are stories that inspire people who aren't sports fans, right? They're fundamentally human stories. And those are very different than the sports columns of the past, which might have just been focused on the scores or the plays. This is what's going on internally, not just externally. And so it's the fans' opportunity now to tell those stories about their own belief, their own faith, and how they think that's real for them.
We've spent most of this time on sports. It's worth noting that you're also very invested in popular music as a vehicle for thinking about this, and your dissertation book was about Bob Marley and the religious context that surrounds his music. We could do a whole nother episode just on that. But I wondered if you could just give us a taste of your thoughts about Bob Marley as we wrap it down.
For folks at home, you didn't just see this huge smile come onto his face.
Totally. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We could certainly do an episode. I'm wearing a Bob Marley shirt too, and there's this big Bob Marley picture in this room, which is one of only 10 pictures like in the world. So that's one of my precious assets. That's what I'll grab if the house catches fire. My kid, and then my dog, and all the sentient beings, and then that picture. I think that for me, my interest in Bob was, like you say, from a religious perspective. Of course, everyone knows Bob Marley is this great musical figure, and many people appreciate Bob Marley is this great political figure. But very little had been written on the fact that he is also a religious figure of significance. And within the Rastafari movement, he is considered a prophet. So what does it mean to consider a popular musician as a prophet? There was a great Sufi teacher, Hazrat Inayat Khan, who said something like, music, even more than religion, extols the highest virtues of what it means of mankind. And that's why the greatest prophets historically have been the greatest musicians. And that really turned me on to this idea that actually there is this intersection between prophetic work and popular culture work. And that Bob was so successful because he was able to channel ideas about meaning, purpose, and justice that were laden with religious significance into his music and introduce people almost through misdirection to ideas about Rastafari or Haile Selassie or Pan Africanism or a movement back to Africa, Garveyism, all these ideas that people would never have tuned into perhaps in and of themselves, they're getting through the music, which they love in a way that they might not otherwise expect, but maybe enlightened by. And so, you know, Bob Marley, for Rastafari, Haile Selassie is God, but Bob Marley was, as a prophet of Jah, of Rastafari, was even more popular than Haile Selassie. He's the reason why we know so much about Selassie. And so for me, Bob Marley represents a synthesis of prophetic work, technology, and popular culture. And what I realized as I was writing about Bob Marley is that religion has all and prophetic work has always been a function of popular culture and technology. This is nothing new. This is just a modern iteration of the old. What I mean by that is that the Sistine Chapel is popular culture. Passion plays are popular culture. Sufi music is popular culture. The ways in which religion has been disseminated historically has been through popular culture and through technology. The reason why the Vedas from India, the ancient traditions of India, never left India is because it was an oral tradition. The reason why Islam was able to spread around the world in 100 years in a way that Christianity wasn't was because of the advent of the printing press, where you could print texts and push them, send them around the world. The reason why Bob Marley was able to spread a brand new religious consciousness, a global denomination into an island denomination into a global religion in less than 10 years, was because of technology, because of popular culture and technology, because he could put his message into music, into CDs, into records that were then pushed all over the world. So as and now today you can click a button and send a message around the world. So as technology has increased, we begin to see the relationship between prophetic work and popular culture. It's always been that way, but Bob Marley was a genius at utilizing the latest technological avenues and recording opportunities he had to disseminate what was a prophetic message. He didn't see himself as a musician. He didn't see himself as an entertainer. He saw himself as a messenger spreading the message of Jah. And this is the way he spread the message of Jah. And so I view Bob Marley as a figure who shows us that this is actually, he's part of a lineage of people who have always done that. This is what prophets have always done. They've always used technology and popular culture to push a message out. And what we know about conversion is people come to faith usually through popular culture and not through the sword. You know, conversion to Islam in India went more through Sufi poets and ideas of music and architecture than they did through the idea of a forced conversion. And so these are the song stories, aspirations that go to our heart. And Bob was a master at that. I also think Bob is important because he was the first third world superstar. And he means something for, you know, the formerly enslaved and indentured people of the world, the formerly colonized people of the world, in a way that these other global stars, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, don't. Bob Marley, to me, is the most popular visage in the world. Wherever I go in the world, I see Bob Marley. I was traveling with yak herders in Tibet in the late 90s at 17,000 feet. And I didn't speak much Tibetan. They didn't speak much English. And we were just singing Bob Marley songs at the roof of the world together. I couldn't believe that, right? So Bob Marley is probably the most popular face in the world wherever you go around the world today. And it's because of his significance to Black and brown people too, that he carries that mantle. And because, you know, the wailers, the idea of wailer is that you cry, you're wailing because you're suffering. The idea that he's channeling the suffering of the third world, of the poor, oppressed, formerly colonized, formerly indentured, formerly enslaved people, I think is something we should be aware of today, we should embrace today, because he offered us a different way to think about global popular culture. It's not just the domain of white European popular culture that's adopted around the world. It's that global popular culture is for all people, but produced by all people too.
Wow. We definitely need to do a show on Bob Marley. That's my first reaction. And second is that is a really powerful and hopeful way to wrap this conversation, which has just been an absolute treat. And I just want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this. So grateful to be with you. And for me too, this was an affirming, joyful conversation at a time I needed it most. So thank you.
I think it was great to have Varun on as a guest. He's always a fascinating thinker and a huge influence on the USC campus and someone that I turn to for inspiration on a regular basis, even as he's taking me into a space of sports, which is just very much not my comfort zone. I mean, this ongoing question of religion and culture, I think, is an interesting one. I don't know how interesting to you, but it's something I keep grappling with. That, you know, is sports religion? Is sports like religion? Is sports a space that's substituting for religion? That's to me an interesting question still.
Yeah, I mean, well, in Varun's telling, it certainly feels like some of the needs that we had met through religion historically are coming through in a variety of forms of popular culture. And, you know, he makes a really strong case for sports as being kind of sports as religion. And some people might not like that, you know, that's too close. But I think in you know, per his the definition he uses, which I looked up from Kathy Albanese, which as the, you know, the religion as consisting of the four C's, creed as the creed as the explanations about the meaning or meanings of life, codes or rules that govern our everyday behavior, cultus or rituals to act out those insights and understandings that are expressed in creeds and codes, and community. So to me, that's a pretty compelling case for, you know, like, okay, so this is in the ballpark. And then he points out that, you know, that religion isn't about learning about God. It's about learning about ourselves. And like in sports, I think we absolutely, and popular culture, we absolutely learn about ourselves. This is a, you know, for me, an ongoing conversation about what we pick up from movies and films and comics and what they tell us about our social and political context. Right. So that does feel like,
yeah, I guess coming up, being raised in Georgia as a Southern Baptist, religion was very much about God and very much about a fixed set of beliefs that you either took on faith or you didn't. And there was this language of false idols that led one spooked by any passion you had that didn't fit within the church. And that was sort of what I had to break with in order to become a fan and to become as passionate and as curious as I am about such a broad range of popular culture. So for me, I'm fascinated by his arguments, and but I struggle with them at the same time because they hit such a hot button, such a historic trauma for me about where the border is between religion and other interest and what it is to cross over from being religious into something else. And you throw into that sports, which for me growing up was, those were the guys who beat me up in the locker room, not something that I ever felt an emotional connection with. If there was any point in my life that I could have been interested in sports, the message I got over and over was it wasn't for me. So if sports becomes the new religion, then I'm finding myself locked out of the new religion too. And it's something that I grapple with when I listen to him in a way. There's got to be more than that. And so I have some hope when he talks about Bob Marley as a space into religion. But I have behind that the concerns about science fiction being often attacked as false worship, as delusional, as not understanding the borders between fantasy and reality. And so there's a lot that I'm still sorting through. Intellectually, I think he's totally convinced me. Emotionally, I've got so much baggage around these questions, as I suspect a lot of listeners may as well, that I grapple with where does that leave us?
Yeah, I mean, as you're talking, I hear that, and it seems like one, it sort of it depends on which, what, you know, what kind of religion and what were the sort of, what were the stories that you were told in that space, and what was the experience like for you, and what was your experience for with sport, right? So you've made that clear that there's a lot of, it's not like a binary where it's, there used to be religion and now there's a new religion and it's called sports. It's, I mean, I think it's sports as a religion. And you can, and as he points out, right, they're just like within traditional religion, there's no shortage of problems in sport, right? In big sport. And hearing the ways that it, they can be exclusionary or abusive or all the, you know, the different things that we're aware of. So, yeah, so it's, I don't think, I guess I don't, I feel far from an expert in this, but I don't feel like it's an endorsement of, it's more of a recognition. And maybe it tracks back to Diane Winston talking about reality television as a new religion, just saying this is what it is doing, not good or bad, just the observation that these are the needs that people are having met in those spaces. And to say that's a phenomenon. And then we can discuss, what do we do with that phenomenon? How do we think about it? How do we respond to it? How do we, you know, build on whatever affordances it grants and try to ameliorate or more the problems that it causes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what leaves me optimistic coming out of it. The discussion of ritual in this exchange sort of leaves us thinking ritual not as something we do to reflect the past, but as something we do to aspire for the future. How do we change our rituals to reflect who we are now and who we want to be in the future? And I think if sports can really do that, if we can make this transition from the mascots and the tomahawk chops and so forth to new rituals, it will be a model for thinking about where the culture needs to go. Because we desperately need new rituals that unify us as a society, just as I think we need new monuments that reflect who we are now and where we want to go, rather than monuments that reflect narrow chapters of our history that were designed to exclude and terrify. And so that idea really interests me. And pop culture is a space of innovation in a way that religion, formalized religion, often has been incredibly resistant to change and fearful of change, and why some of the most religious segments of our population have been some of the most arch conservative in recent years, is change is frightening. So how do we model how ritual adopts to change, I think, is very interesting. When we did one of our civic imagination workshops in Fayetteville, Arkansas, at a Lutheran church, and one of the questions we asked the people there was the future of faith, the future of religion. And the consensus was that in the future, there would not need to be churches and religion, because God's relationship to man would be manifest in the way human beings related to each other. And so in a world where religion had been fulfilled, there would be no need for the rituals and institutions of formalized religion, which was just a mind-boggling idea, that this church was talking about an idealized future where the church itself withered away and ceased to exist. But that was, to me, one of the few times I've encountered an institution of higher religion that imagined an alternative future to the rituals that they governed their lives with for so long.
Whew. Yeah, I do. I feel like in every space of the world right now, from, you know, no longer being able to shake hands or hug someone to, you know, our intimate relationships being carried out via Zoom to, you know, all the way up the stack through the monuments and other social forms, that we are ripe for reinvention of these rituals as we kind of have this collective realization of how many things were broken. So that I think is promising. And I think, as you say, the speed with which popular culture moves and the way that it touches so many people and is sort of, in some instances, at least designed to be more inclusive, creates some neat opportunities. And I hope that we can be, I don't know if you can be intentional in ritual design, but to the extent that we can, to really be thinking about what are stable and sustainable human and pro-social values that are inclusive and empower, you know, that are kind of where we want to go, not where we are now, because that would be something we don't want to reflect. But what does that look like? And then I think the other thing that gives me that I kind of want to chew more on was, as he was talking about, how important it is for text to be open to reinterpretation, right? Whether it's the Bible or the Constitution or anything else, is that it's like that we keep seeing new ways to understand these things. And I feel like we do that regularly as we talk about movies or comics or books or other kinds of, you know, stories that have happened in the past. And we sort of see them in new lights as the context around us shifts. And so that sort of the ability to reinterpret and to make these rituals and other changes current to the now and connect them to our now, not just ancient, to me feels like an opportunity and a challenge, like in places like sports, where so much of it is based on the canon, right? There is a thing, there are negative valences to religion for me of sports is like, well, we have the national anthem before the game because that's how it always has been, you know? And so it'll be interesting to see whether traditional sports can change, and also what it looks like to have new sports, esports or other kinds of emergent things that aren't burdened by those stable interpretations and set rituals, but that may be more inviting to new ways of doing things that are in keeping with the moment and where we want to travel as a society.
Well, this week, you brought me a little deeper into your world by helping me to understand sports a little better. So I really appreciate that introduction.
It was great to be with you on the journey as ever. Our special thanks to the John Jay and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, who generously support this podcast. Well, we are normally hosted by the University of Southern California here in Los Angeles, although we're at home right now. USC and our homes in Los Angeles sit on the traditional lands of the Tongva people.
We are ably assisted by our wonderful producers, Sophie Maje and Josh Chang.
You can find us online at howdoyoulikeitsofar.org or on Instagram and Twitter at @HDYLISF_pod. H-D-Y-L-I-S-F underscore pod.
That's easy for you to say.